namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa Buddhang Dhammang Sanghang Namasami.
I'm taking the Four Noble Truths as the basic framework or underlying structure of our understanding of practice and our the way we practice and our realization of the fruits of practice. We are all, I'm sure, quite aware that the third noble truth of nirodha, cessation, has not yet been realized or fully realized by us, and that the fourth noble truth of magga, the path, also not yet has reached fruition. But perhaps we can overlook the fact that we also don't yet really understand. We haven't penetrated the meaning of the first two noble truths. And this is perhaps a crucial point, that although we have all suffered and are suffering, and are going to continue suffering for at least some time in the future, we don't yet really know what suffering is. We haven't comprehended suffering. Not only have we not comprehended suffering, we haven't really grasped, we haven't really understood clearly in the sense of realized, made real to us, to ourselves, to our hearts and minds, the truth that suffering, unsatisfactoriness, dukkha, arises from craving and ignorance. Although in the formulation of the Four Noble Truths, craving is chosen by the Buddha as the cause of suffering. We shouldn't, of course, forget that wherever there is tanha, wherever there is craving, there is ignorance. The two are inseparable. So the Noble Eightfold Path leading to cessation is one of seeking to come to terms with seeking to comprehend the nature of dukkha and to make clear, to see in which way that dukkha is conditioned, is caused by craving. And we have, when we divide the Noble Eightfold Path into the three stages, three trainings, this is the active presentation, if you like. We talk about the Eightfold Path is more like a static or a passive presentation. The threefold training, although it covers the same ground, is a more active way of talking about it. So what we're trying to do is to see defilements as defilements. Now, they're a very simple phrase. At the same time, a profound one. The word defilement in kilesa that the Buddha chose, it was not an arbitrary one. And the Buddha is pointing to this sense of dirtying, sullying, defiling of something which is not necessarily or not inherently dirty, sullied, or defiled. The defilements are things which arise and pass away according to causes and conditions. We are not subject to original defilement. Defilements arise according to causes and conditions. They're not here all the time. And seeing that defiling action of the defilements is seeing dukkha. And to see dukkha in a very practical, concrete kind of way. So in this threefold training, sila allows us to see defilements as defilements through as explained in the talks on sila, through faith taking on a certain training, precepts, consciously adopting certain kinds of volition, which we are taught are wholesome volitions, and we remember those, we seek to remember them, to bear them in mind, to consolidate them in consciousness so that they are ready to arise when the opportunities for the unwholesome volitions, which are there, which are directly contrary to them, arise in the mind. It's to say, for instance, we take on consciously the volition to refrain from taking life. When the intention to take life arises in the mind, if we have internalized, if we've brought our sila inwards, then that intention to take life will ring a button, and it'll bring up the intention not to take life most automatically. We remember our intention not to take life when the intention to take life arises. So that intention not to take life, having arisen, gives us a perspective on the intention to take life. In other words, it illuminates unwholesome intention, and within the steady gaze of mindfulness and clear awareness, we sense the rashness, the lack of circumspection, the hurried disturbed state of mind which has arisen together with that volition. We see to a certain extent, at least, that that is a defiled volition. So here on the level of sila, we are enabling ourselves to see defilement as defilement, at least on one level. It's not yet on perhaps the highest level, which will allow us to completely abandon the defilement, but it's providing a foundation for that kind of knowing. So if we were just to take the general standard, that of being mindful, not allowing defilements to arise in the mind, often we find that our mindfulness isn't sharp enough, that our tendency to forget is much stronger than our tendency to remember. Having precepts and regulations and so on and so forth for us to return to, or which we can bring to mind, enable us to illuminate the unwholesome volitions in our mind and the defilements in our mind, in other words, and to see defilements as defilements. On the next stage, on the training of the jitter of the mind and heart through samatha meditation, the effort to bring the mind to a single point or a single physical sensation or a single theme, a single word, illuminates the distracted nature of mind, its madness, its willfulness, its fickleness. We see just how unwilling it is to be still. And the very effort to anchor the mind to a meditation object illuminates the habitual activity of the mind very clearly. We begin to note the kinds of sensual desires, ill will, that arise. We notice depression, the discouragement, the dullness, the torpor. We notice the agitation. We notice the doubts. We notice these things because we have something separate and apart from them, something which is unmoving, as a contrast to their movement. It's a basic kind of principle that you can only determine the rate, nature of movement when you have something still to compare it with. So we have the meditation object as a still point. And the degree to which we can still the mind is the degree to which we are impressed by the defiling nature of the defilements, the sense of aversion, turning away from, tiredness with, disenchantment with defilements, arises in direct proportion to our ability to focus the mind and to realize the bliss, the happiness, the cool rapture of the undistracted mind. If you have experience of non-distraction, your experience of one-pointedness, then the phenomena of the nivaranas of the hindrances becomes painful, unpleasant, not worth the trouble, not worth the time that we spend indulging in them. We see that very clearly now, that the happiness and satisfaction that we derive from indulgence in such mental states is far outweighed by the detrimental effects. So we're beginning to see things as they are, seeing defilements as defilements, through seeing the undefiled mind, even if only temporarily undefiled, as undefiled. But one of the characteristic features of Buddhist teachings, one which distinguishes it from other similar religions that grew up in India, particularly the yogic traditions, is that the Buddha saw clearly that the samatha practice is very successful in suppressing hindrances, keeping them down, but is not capable of completely extirpating them, not capable of completely removing them from the mind once and for all. And for this, we need the wisdom faculty. So this wisdom faculty can be explained very simply as the recognition of the awareness of the impermanent, unstable, and impersonal nature of phenomena. It's not like a 1, 2, 3 kind of process. In that way, the three characteristics are intimately related, can't really be separated from each other, but the way into that the nature of existence may vary from person to person. For some, or for majority of people, impermanence is the way, is the gate into this nature, the way things are. And for others, that may be dukkha, for others may be anatta. They can be separated in speech, but the realization is of all three simultaneously. So it's here where finally dukkha is seen as dukkha, and the defilements are seen clearly in their entirety and for what they are. And as and they are in that way abandoned. So the way of practice then is dealing with behavior, body and speech through sila, and the citta through samadhi, wisdom, and the ignorance dealt with through wisdom. Traditionally, it's said that samadhi works most effectively on tanha. It's banya that works on avijja, or ignorance. Now, when we start looking at the word defilement and the explanations of defilements in the suttas, in the teachings, we'll find that there are many different ways of talking about this defiling action, according to a particular effect on the mind. There are various reasons for grouping defilements in different ways and giving them different names, sometimes for purely for rhetorical purposes, for teaching purposes, or grouping them according to some particular theme. For instance, you have like the four ogres or the four floods, where the Buddha is choosing to speak particularly about the flooding nature of the way that defilements flood the mind, overwhelm the mind, just as a tidal wave does. Another other ways, apart from the Nivaranas, we have, of course, the Asavas, which is very commonly used, and arahantship usually defined in terms of the extinction of the asavas. The Nivaranas, particularly those defilements which are put down, suppressed, transcended in samatha practice, and so on and so forth. But there are certain some defilements are more subtle and harder to see than others. The proclivities, the anusayas, an example of the more subtle kinds of defilements. There is another group which is mentioned quite frequently in the suttas, and which I always found a good one to reflect on. When we talk about lists of defilements, it's a good exercise for those who attend to them, these lists, in the right way, and it's not such a good exercise for those who attend to them in the wrong way. That's to say, if you start hearing long lists of defilements, it can be very easy to get rather depressed and downhearted. you hear each one, you say, yes, that's me, that's me. And think it's almost as if the Buddha is talking about you personally. I might say there are three kinds of people in the world, and this is not meaning to be imitating the Buddha here, but some people, the lowest category, if you like, are people who don't see that they have defilements and don't feel any sense of recognition when defilements are mentioned. The modern term for this, I guess, is sort of denial. Then the second group of people are people who hear lists of defilements and they think that that's me and I have that kind of defilement, like it's a personal problem, a personal failing. And there are many of us who carry around this sense of guilt. It's ready to own up to everything, even when we're not guilty. And that kind of character is one which tends to grasp at these lists unwisely. But the third kind of practitioner, of course, the wisest one is one that sees defilements, understands that defilements are conditions which arise and pass away, that they don't belong to anybody, that they're not any more inherent or any more really who we are than are the enlightenment factors, for instance. But somehow, you notice we tend to have the feeling somehow that defilements are somehow more really who we are than positive virtues. That's a deeply cynical view of human nature, that virtue is merely a mask for sin. The virtuous are merely those that haven't yet been discovered. So, just to go through this list quite briefly, otherwise it might get a little bit too long. The first one of the list of what are called the 16 upakilesas is apicca wissamalopa in Pali, which is the only one in this list which is exclusively or quite clearly a matter of greed, lust. So in that case, perhaps we can take it as representative for all kinds of unwholesome desire, right from the very coarsest kind of desire, which would be the case of wanting, seeking something which doesn't belong to us, property of somebody else, planning ways of getting that thing which we want, and being so obsessed with a desire for it that we lose our sense of right and wrong, what's proper and improper. And lobha and greed does have this this nature, doesn't it, to obsess the mind, for us to lose our sense of perspective and to become overly impressed by the positive, alluring aspects of the object and to skip over, gloss over or ignore the unpleasant aspects. And this the more you focus and the more you're drawn in and the more defiled the mind becomes. Now, these lists are enabling us to stand back from our experience and to really look in our daily life, not just in the meditation. How do we notice this defilement arising? What are the things that condition it, particularly kinds of, in the daily life? If there's sorts of sexual desire, desire for food, a desire for comfort, desire for material things, immaterial things, What sort of things does our mind desire? What does desire do to the mind? What is the feeling of wanting something? So, and seeing, trying to see clearly how that disturbs the mind and how dangerous it is for the welfare of the mind and welfare of our bodies as well. Because with the mind obsessed with lust and desire, we can do things which can be for long-standing suffering of the body. We can indulge in things which cause ill effects to our health, of course. Then the next three points are all aspects of hatred, dosa. But here the Buddha is dividing into three distinct defiling forces or defilements. Vyapada means ill will, malice. This is the most extreme form, where one is just sitting and thinking of ways to hurt somebody or to make life difficult for them, or fantasizing all sorts of horrible accidents that might happen to them, and just indulging in thoughts of ill will and hurting. This is one of the most harmful things that you can do to your mind. Second, short only of committing suicide, perhaps it's the shortest, quickest way to destroy the qualities of the good qualities of the mind. It's sitting around thinking of nasty things you could do, nasty things you could say, ways of making someone hurt or feel pain in some way. The next one is kota, and this is just anger that arises. You see something, you hear something, you experience something that you don't like. You don't want it to be that way. It's a frustration of your desires or frustration of your ideas of how things should be. And a sense of outrage. And of course, the most insidious kind of fuel for outrage, especially amongst religious people, is righteous indignation, sense of being right, and sense that they're wrong. You know that they're wrong. And anger at people's wrongness is somehow seems less of a defilement somehow. You feel you're justified. It's all right to get angry because they're really doing something which is harmful, and be harmful to the community, harmful to the sasana. And again, tuning into that, just seeing how that feels, what that's like, and seeing it as a defilement. Can we find that middle way between pretending we're not angry, denying that we're angry, and totally indulging in anger and exulting in anger, but seeing anger for what it is, how anger affects body and mind, just the heat, the tension, the physical and mental ill effects of anger are not difficult to see. But when our intention is to see defilement as defilement, not as a personal failing to feel bad about, discouraged about, or not to completely disown and make excuses about, but to see a defilement arising, causes and conditions, this is the path to freedom. This is the way we can start to develop disenchantment towards it. Disenchantment comes from clear seeing. Don't have to produce or try to be disenchanted with something so much. Just seeing it clearly for what it is enough. Another closely related upakilesa or defilement is grudge bearing. And this again is what they say, like rust of the heart, is something which is detrimental, hurtful, harmful to the mind. And see, some of us can catch and feel the moment one thinks about it, the moment that comes to mind, the anger and the reaction is almost as strong as it was at the time. There's no fading of it, because there's no sense of it or as a defilement. For me, in clearer moments, we think, no, it's not such a good habit, it's not such a good thing. But at the same time, there's still this part of us which doesn't want to let it go. Why don't we want to let it go? Because we haven't yet seen the defilement as defilement. So there are, again, dealing with defilements, when we haven't yet seen it, what do? Then, okay, you should try and see defilements as a defilement, but you can't do that yet. What do? Well, you endure through it. At least you don't act on it with body and speech. You allow it to be there and you just stick with it. You just bear with it, even though it's painful. You know, this is it. This is how it is. And look at it quite clearly. You know, let it show itself in its true colors. And be willing to do that, having the courage to do that. And you begin to see the defiling nature. You begin to understand what this word defilement means. You have to keep coming back to that. We don't know what defilement means. We use this word a lot in Buddhist circles, but we don't yet really know what it means. Not clearly enough, because if we did, the defilements couldn't find a harbor in our minds. So we're trying to see defilements as defilements, trying to see this grudge bearing. And of course, we don't only have to learn from our own experience, and learn from other people, from how those things are shown in other people's actions, behavior, and their lives. And we can learn both from within and without. Okay, so the next defilement, these defilements tend to be in pairs, and the next one is called makkha. Makkha means denigrating or refusing to accept the good qualities of other people, particularly superiors or elders, trying to put down others. And of course, at the same time you put down others, you're lifting yourself up. So ways of criticizing, pointing out faults in other people in order to lift yourself up in comparison. This is something which may be done in terms of speech, in terms of speaking with other people, or you may just do it in your mind, trying to lift yourself up and put other people down. And a defilement which forms a pair with this is putting yourself on the same level as others. So these kinds of defilements, ways of trying to assert yourself, trying to stand forth as someone. These are defilements of people who lack a sense of gratitude for teachings that they've received. I think it's a very significant point and a quality that you notice in the greatest teachers, just their sense of abiding loyalty, gratitude to teachers. I was reminded of Lumpu Man. Lumpu Man had practiced with Lumpo Sao. Lumpo Man had finished his practice before Lumpur Sao. At that time, I think Lumpur Man must have had over 20 pansars. And the first thing he thought was to repay his debt of gratitude to his teacher. And so they went off and spent the rains retreat together in a cave. And although at this time, as I say, Ajahn Mun had over 20 pansars, he did all the acharya work for Ajahn Sao. He waited for a couple of months before the time was right for him to give some teaching to Ajahn Sao. He did it in a very correct and respectful way. So at that time, Ajahn Sao was not yet even a Sotapanna because he'd taken particular vow, Adhidhana, to be a Pacheka Buddha. Ajahn Mun was an Arahant, 20 Pansa plus Arahant, but he still felt this incredible gratitude to the teachings that he'd received from Ajahn Sao. And he went back to do his best to repay that debt of gratitude. And he was successful, and Ajahn Sao realized Arahantship in that pansar also. The ability to recognize and to honor any kind of help and assistance that one's had on the path is a wonderful quality to develop. Sometimes we can overlook this point, I think. Sometimes monks can go off to branch monasteries and find perhaps practice not quite what they'd hoped for, not so inspiring, and the ajahn not so inspiring as they'd hoped. But if you can develop that gratitude, which comes through seeing the power and the beauty of the Dhamma, and how when you consider how difficult it is to be born as a human being, how difficult it is to come into contact with the Dhamma, you realize just if you were just to receive just one line of just one sentence of Dhamma teaching, or just one bit of advice on one of the minor rules of training, you're all already incredibly indebted to that person, that ajahn. And say in the pansar this year, the way we're doing the vinaya is where most of the monks will be contributing, will be teaching the vinaya. So the rest of us will be indebted to them for that. They've been our vinaya teachers for a certain part of the vinaya at least. And that's, you can see what a sort of noble kind of quality that is when we have this love for the Dhamma and respect and appreciation for the Dhamma. Then anyone who shares the Dhamma with us or teaches us the Dhamma, even if they haven't realized the Dhamma to the highest extent, then we feel with gratitude for them. We've seen some teachers who, particularly in one or two other traditions, contemporary Western teachers who've practiced with a particular guru or teacher, and then sometime later completely rejected the teacher and said they'd gone beyond their teacher and the teacher's knowledge was limited. And now they've realized something that no one else has ever known before, and they've got a new way of teaching and so on. And that for me is not a characteristic of a truly wise or noble person. Belittling that which you've received from others, belittling the bun kun, or the belittling one's debt of gratitude is a defilement the Buddha's talking about here. So this list of dhammas is good in that these are things perhaps in formal meditation practice where we may not notice these things coming up in the same way as we notice nivaranas, we notice more agitation and drowsiness and so on and so forth, and we put them down, particularly on the way of samatha where we don't pay so much attention to particular nature or content of defilements and nirvanas. But these upakilesas can affect our whole attitude to practice, you know, the framework within which we're practicing. And so having this kind of map or these pointers just to, you know, do we have this kind of tendency in our minds is very useful. I've had to write them down because I've given this talk before and I've got stuck halfway through, so please forgive me for this. Okay, the next one is it's called Isa, which is jealousy. The Thai idiom for this is very good. It's hot eyes. I think your eyes get hot when you see someone experiencing some success in some particular endeavor, or being happy with something. We tend to, I think that jealousy is a mode of lopa or greed, but the texts point out that it is in fact a mode of dosa. They say that you can't bear to see someone else experiencing some success or happiness that you haven't. So it's not that you want that for yourself, but you feel displeased to see someone else doing well. And, this is something which can come up quite a lot. And if you're having a very difficult time in your meditation, for instance, and then you see someone who's sitting very straight and seems very composed and seems to have very good meditation, then it was quite a natural tendency, isn't it, for feeling of jealousy to arise. Now, I remember many years ago when I was a young monk, and one of the other monks was very good sitting meditation, and I was having a lot of trouble, but at the same time, I used to find it very inspiring to see him sitting there like a rock. And then one day I walked into the sala and I just saw him nodding. And this is a very strong mixture of emotions came in my mind. And one feeling was one of disappointment, someone that I'd never seen sort of nodding and looking sleepy. And it was like some sort of some very strong pillar had started to shake. But at the same time, and I was shocked to see it myself, but I had to, you know, there was a sense of pleasure. I actually enjoyed seeing him, that he wasn't perfect, you know, that that there was something in me which was displeased, the fact that he sat so much better than I did. And I think probably everybody feels the same. You know, you want to be able to practice well, and sometimes you can't. If you see someone who seems to be much better, more geng at something which you aspire to be good and to be geng at, it's quite natural. But to see that and own up to it, if we do aspire to goodness and nobility, then sometimes it can be very hard to own up to the things which are rather ignoble. In a community, it's a lot easier to see these things than when you're by yourself. This is one of the problems about living in a solitary life, that you tend to put your emphasis on your strong points and to ignore your weak points, and to brush away or to turn your back on these kinds of defilements, because it's just too depressing, you feel, to want to look at that kind of stuff. And those things can become ingrained in your mind without you realizing it, and certain kinds of imbalances and defilements. So living in community helps, and having these kinds of objective lists of criteria where you have to go through them one by one and just be very honest with yourself, and don't try and make out that it doesn't really matter, it's not a big thing. Then macharya means, it's hard to get a good English translation of this. Stinginess is the one that's usually used, and a kind of a possessiveness, an unwillingness to share that which you derive benefit from with others. Could be wealth, requisites, material things like this. Could be knowledge, could be dhamma, anything which you feel is good, is of benefit to you, and you feel this, that you don't want anybody else to have it, you want to keep it just for yourself. This is macharya. And the Buddha said that someone who has this defilement, cannot realize jhana, cannot pacify their mind. It's a very basic and insidious defilement. And this is why so much importance is in the initial stages of practice is given to dana, to giving, because dana is that wholesome dhamma which directly works on this possessiveness, which is a basic and defilement for those living in the household life, and but also for monastics, and one of the kinds of macharya which Buddha spoke of as pertaining particularly to monastics is that of it's called macharya with sakula macharya, which means for instance a monk has a lay supporter who has a great deal of faith in him and supports him with the requisites, and then he tries to prevent that lay supporter having any contact with other monks because he's afraid that lay supporter might develop faith in other monks and then lose faith in him, or start offering requisites to other monks and offer them to him. This is a sort of defilement particular to monastics. This is macharya. And of course, all these defilements, they're going from coarse to subtle. This subtle kind of possessiveness and holding on to things and not wanting to share things is something which can appear in quite refined ways in the mind. Next defilement is maya, deceit. It's trying to present things other than they are for some particular purpose. Perhaps you want people to respect you, you're afraid that people will look down on you if you know the truth, trying to manipulate people's opinions, trying to get things, trying to become something in other people's eyes, generally being deceitful and tricky and misleading. And a pair with this one and somewhat related to it is satya, which rather misleadingly in most English translations is called hypocrisy, but the most of the Thai translations, and I think it seems more accurate to me, render it as meaning boastfulness or claiming to be better than you are, or trying to project this image of yourself, or it could be merely liking to talk about one's own good qualities, or only showing one's own good qualities to others, trying to be more, to appear to be more than you are, to attain more than you have attained. Tamba, the next one, and tamba means obstinacy, obduracy, stubbornness. This is a defilement which can be seen particularly clearly in the inhabitants of this part of the world. It's very much part of their makeup. But, everyone has it to some degree. It's like the mule who just sticks his feet in and won't go, he draws the line. Of course, if you are an obstinate person, you probably conceive yourself as being one who sticks to principles. And you know, where is the line drawn between being one who sticks to principles and being intransigent and stubborn? Here, it's, again, one has to be clear just to what extent it's motivated by self-interest or ignorance and moha. And just, you know, wanting to draw a line somewhere and just not moving come what may. Obstinate person is someone who's difficult to teach. Difficult. He's not someone who's going to learn anything very easily. He's rigid. Actually, the word tamba is a word for like a pillar or a pole or a post. It's embedded in the ground. It won't move. It has no flexibility. This stiffness of mind, narrowness of mind, is defilement, and to be recognized. And then sarampa is competitiveness. This is perhaps most prominently, might say, North American defilement, something which is bred into Western psyche, particularly North American psyche, that one can only really find effort, can only really be purposeful and really achieve something by competing with others and getting ahead. And this kind of rivalry between monks that sometimes occurs, rivalry in terms of sitting for long periods, rivalry in terms of any kind of the achievements for which monks are praised, generally gauging oneself in relation to the person one conceives as one's competitor. That kind of energy is obviously quite contrary to the idea of the brahmacharya, idea of the holy life, in which we're you need to develop this idea of being comrades and brothers in the holy life and helping each other, seeing each other as companions in old age, sickness and death. Again, something to be made aware of, that competitive instinct may be so ingrained in one's whole way of being that one, very difficult to even pick up on that. Unless it's, you know, the Buddha's very compassionately pointed it out to us. That's a defilement. That defiles your mind. It's something to be recognized and abandoned. But see it first. See it for what it does to your mind. Mana, conceit. Conceit is of many different kinds. Conceit is taking yourself to be something in particular, someone in particular. And feeling that you have to maintain that particular state of being, or that you have to try and maintain that in other people's eyes as well. There's a tension there. This is one of the most difficult defilements to abandon. Only the arahant fully abandons it. But suffice to say here that includes feelings of being inferior to others, being on the same level as others, and as being superior to others. Conceit doesn't only mean feeling superior. Feeling inferior, sort of false humility, is also a form of conceit. But the underlying idea of mana is that you have an idea of yourself as someone. You identify with, particular role, say, identify yourself being an ajahn, or as being a monk, or as being a Buddhist, or as being a man, or as being a woman, or and taking that far too seriously, and becomes mana. Atimana, the next defilement is something which is extreme form of that, but that particularly when it's a contempt for people outside the group. It might be contempt for those who feel don't have the same qualities as you do, not as good as you are, not as committed as you are, not as honest, or people who are not in your group, who don't have share the same faith and beliefs as you do. And this is Atimana. Then mother is this sense of intoxication, we're just completely caught up in something and lose all a sense of balance, perspective, it's a sense of drunkenness, madness, intoxication with certain mental states, with certain states of being. And finally, the most important, or the elephant's footprint, if you like, pramada, or heedlessness. And when there's this heedlessness, is lack of sati, then all the other defilements can arise. And not being complacent, not taking advantage of the opportunities that we have for practice, being lazy, putting things off, can always do it tomorrow, living as if we're immortal, living as if we really do have the time to do all that we want to do whenever we want to do it, not putting forth the effort now, always about to do it, always getting ready, getting into the right frame of mind to do it, but never quite getting around to it. And this is heedlessness, lack of mindfulness, lack of awareness, lack of care, lack of effort and application. And this is the most fundamental kind of defilement. So this is a long list, and I've been talking for quite a long while, and I've had to treat them quite cursorily. But this is to give you a kind of a framework, something to take away and to reflect on at length for yourself, and make the kind of reflection of this nature part of your practice. It steadies you and gives you a wider kind of vision of how you're doing, how the practice is going. Are these defilements becoming less? Are they diminishing? Are they weakening? Are they the same as they were? Are they getting stronger? This is a reliable way of gauging progress in practice, rather than meditation sittings can vary in quality quite a lot, and you can go through periods of a lot of peace, and then periods of not so much peace, and then periods of not very much peace at all. It's not such a good way of judging progress in practice, but the changes over a long period in terms of the arising, passing away defilements is a lot more useful way of just looking at how much one is progressing on the path. So I'd just like to go through this list of 16 defilements or upakilesas as a summary to end this talk. So the first one was abhijja visama lopa, this of desire, covetousness, covering all the lobha, the range of defilements under the umbrella of lobha. Then three which are exclusively dosa kinds of defilements, there's ill will or malice, anger, grudge bearing, and then maka, which is denigrating others, not accepting the owning up to or acknowledging one's debt of gratitude to others. Palasa, trying putting oneself on the same level as one's seniors. Jealousy, stinginess, deceit, boastfulness, stubbornness, competitiveness, conceit, contempt, intoxication, and heedlessness. And may all of you listening to the talk this evening quickly be free of all of those defilements.